You are listening to Inside Biotech, an exciting new podcast from Biotech Connection Los Angeles, which focuses on the science behind Southern California's most innovative new biotech companies. For those listeners who are new to the podcast, BCLA is an organization dedicated to inspire, educate, and connect emerging scientists and entrepreneurs to grow and diversify biotech in LA. I'm your host, Dr. Yuande Pierce, and I'm so excited to welcome you to episode 4 of season 2 of the podcast. If you want to stay informed about current progress and developments in the biotech industry, then you've definitely come to the right place, and I hope that you'll subscribe and keep coming back each month. I'll be talking with different scientists, entrepreneurs, and investors about the cutting-edge science that goes on inside their companies, touching on a range of themes from across Southern California's biotech industry. This month, we'll be ending the dish on biotech in food. And we'll be shifting gears a bit to speak with Dr. Robert Goldberg, who is a professor in the Molecular Cell and Developmental Biology Department at UCLA, and who specializes in plant genomics, or the mechanism behind the DNA implants. Professor Goldberg's research has provided a conceptual foundation for the processes that regulate gene expression in higher plants. One of the biggest challenges faced by humanity in the 21st century is the future of food. The human population keeps growing, but our ability to grow crops and sustain these levels is stagnating. A solution to increasing crop yield, however, may be taking root on a super microscopic level in the genetics of creating a seed. Increasing seed yield ought to contribute a great deal to enhancing our food supply, because over half of the major crops used for human consumption are actually seed crops. Fascinated by the sprouting of this new solution, we sat down with Dr. Goldberg on the final episode of the second series, The Dish on Food in Biotech. Welcome, Professor Goldberg, to Inside Biotech. It's such a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoy being here with you. It's a pleasure.
It's a pleasure is all mine. We've had entrepreneurs and investors on this series so far. So as a fellow academic, I've been really excited to get into some of the work that you've been doing and sort of pick apart some of the science. So we're really excited. And I think the first question or first thing to say is, what an incredible background. There is so much in there. And I'm wondering, first off, whether you could have predicted that you'd end up being such a pioneer of plant genetics. Is this something that you've always been interested in? It'd be great to get a bit of an origin story.
Oh my God, no. If anyone told me that I was doing this now, you know, every one of my, when I go to my high school reunions, they can't even believe that got out of college. No.
Wow.
I was certainly not a science expert when I was going through school. I think a lot of these things are evolutionary processes. You start something, you follow a path, you get inspired by something or someone, you follow that path, you network with someone else or something, and you wind up in a place which you really never could have imagined when you started. And that's kind of my story. It's really more of a Cinderella story. I think when I started, it was way back in the early 60s, that long ago. You know, it was almost 60 years ago when I started college. And that time was a very exciting time because it was right after Sputnik went up. And there was a lot of emphasis on science and technology because of the Cold War and the race to get a satellite up around the Earth. Very different times, maybe even forgotten times. But yet for those of us that were going through school at that time, it was kind of exciting, and science was kind of a mystery. And there was a feeling that if you went into science, it was like a new frontier, and you could almost do anything that you wanted to do. And so with that as a backdrop, I went to college. And my first semester in college, I was very privileged to stumble upon a biology class by Professor Norman Cohn at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio, which is the oldest university in the United States outside of the original 13 colonies. And I was just amazed by him because he was this dynamic, young, you know, just vibrant professor. And he got me really, really excited about the field of plants and the field of plant genetics. And in fact, Norm became a mentor of mine my entire life until he sadly passed away, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And so he was an inspiration for someone who was considering either becoming a lawyer, because in high school, they used to call me the Philadelphia lawyer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. and we're going to science. And so I decided to go into science, and particularly plant science, with Norm because he invited me to work in his lab. And to be honest with you, not spending too much time on this backstory, science was much more difficult and challenging for me than was political science or maybe becoming a lawyer. Because of the times, one could get National Defense Education Act scholarships to go to college, which I had, and then National Defense Education Act fellowships to go to graduate school. And so I think the times kind of influenced my original trajectory. But I still retained my love for political science and was a dual major. I majored in political science and botany, if you can believe that, but that's true.
We'll be back after a word from our sponsors.
Hello, I'm Leslie, the outreach lead at BCLA, and I'm here with some messages from our sponsors. Canon Design is a global living-centered design firm that has helped leading biotech and science companies create spaces around the world where people and science flourish. They are consistently recognized as one of the most innovative design firms on the planet. Siddhartha Mukherjee, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author and cancer researcher, tells us, "Science begins with counting. To understand a phenomenon, a scientist must first describe it. To describe it objectively, he must first measure it. As fellow scientists, we all agree that measurements are the foundation on which everything else is built. And yet, as we start to apply machine learning techniques to more areas of research, there is an appalling lack of measurements in the machine learning field. Brainome.ai changes all of this with our data compiler, the first measurements-based tool for bioinformatics research. If you want to incorporate measurements into your computational work, be it biology, chemistry, genomics, or physics, then visit www.brainome.ai for a free demo version of the software."
Wow, what an amazing intersection to have so much knowledge about. And I think that they must inform each other. And having that background, I think, just makes for a better understanding of the work that you do, I imagine. As you were talking about the times and all of this interest in science, I suddenly thought about the last year and COVID and what this might mean for future scientists, or, you know, scientists in the making who also maybe, like yourself, were not initially interested in this field.
Right. Well, I think science is very exciting. It's come a long, long, long way. In talking about my trajectory, it's hard to believe that I was taking college genetics classes only about 9 years after the discovery of the DNA double helix. So the amount of knowledge was almost very primitive. My freshman science majors know more about genetics and genetic engineering and biotechnology and everything than the whole body of knowledge back when I started. But I think it's really important that a lot of young kids are really getting excited in science because they see how important it is to their lives. And clearly COVID and vaccine development over the last year was really a remarkable, remarkable achievement. But in terms of the trajectory of science, being able to make mRNA vaccines to treat us and prevent us from getting this horrible, horrible plague is something that really originated with the origins of genetic engineering, which was 40 years ago. That's when genetic engineering was invented. And before that, no one even thought about it because it was really a remarkable, remarkable transformation of biology, which has had probably more influence on the amount of knowledge we have about cells and organisms and evolution and medicine than almost any discovery, broad discovery, in recent modern times. And I've been fortunate, you know, to be at UCLA as a young professor when genetic engineering was discovered. And the trajectory of genetic engineering, the path and evolution, goes step by step with my career, which has been very exciting.
I mean, it really does blow my mind just to think about the fact that you have seen firsthand the development of all of these technologies that have really exploded in the last decade. And, you know, you're at the beginning, but now you're also, you know, in the field and the, as you say, the fruits of all of those discoveries are really coming to the forefront, and things like COVID really put a spotlight on the importance of these very simple but such so widely applicable technologies.
Well, it's been really exciting because to see the origins of genetic engineering, in fact, one of the real pioneers in doing some technical things was in the lab next to me, and Winston Salzer, who went on to found Amgen, which is the largest biotechnology company in the world, practically. And to see that in the beginning, and then to see the beginning of plant biotechnology, and to be on the board of some of the original plant biotech companies and see the maturation of that as a field and get to know really the founders of that field and apply it in my own research step by step by step as the decades have gone by. And to be able to take, for example, genes that were discovered in my laboratory at UCLA and see that they're now in tens and tens of millions of acres of canola plants in Canada should have a major impact on their yield, how much they produce oil. In other words, to go from basic discoveries in my lab to see it translated to real agricultural gains and seeds in farmers' hands have been really exciting parts of my career path and things that I do and still continue to do.
That is so exciting. I think gratifying is an understatement to be able to see the translation of your work. I too am working on, you know, molecular biology techniques, and you never imagine actually seeing them having such a wide impact in the world. And then at the same time, as you mentioned Amgen, a lot of these companies that have created these, made these technologies accessible just in terms of stem cell culture and what we can do now is amazing. So before we get more into the science, and just to make sure that our audience are all on the same page, and we talk about your work specifically, what is genetic modification of crops and why do we do it? Would you be able to just explain briefly?
Well, the question is, what's a genetically modified organism? It's like to say, what's a GMO? A source of a lot of misconceptions. You know, genetic modification goes back thousands and thousands of years. If you walk around your grocery store, no matter which one it is, it could be Whole Foods, it could be Gelson's, it could be Ralph's, it could be Vaughn's, all the vegetables and all the plant matter in that grocery store really is the product of genetic engineering. So it's really directed genetic change that is changing the composition of genes in an organism to suit humankind, to suit our needs. And our early ancestors, thousands and thousands of years ago, did it because they needed a source of food. They needed a stable source of food. And they were very clever and very imaginative, even though they didn't have the technological tools that we have today, and they didn't understand the underlying principles, but they saw things that could help their families. They saw things that could help their fellow citizens in the regions where they live. And they manipulated plants just by observation and selected breeding. And that's what gave us all of the domesticated plants and all of the domesticated animals, and was responsible really for the origins of agriculture, which has gone on for, as I said, thousands of years. But it wasn't until the 20th century, after Mendel's laws were rediscovered only 120 years ago. It's kind of hard to imagine. Mendel's laws were only discovered, the laws of genetics, 120 years ago, and yet now we've sequenced the human genome. We've sequenced almost every genome of organisms on the face of this earth. We can make mRNA vaccines within a year, and all of that science transpired over the last 120 years. And so when Mendel's laws were reinvented, well, rediscovered, I should say, that meant that we could use the principles of genetics, breeding techniques, to make those breeding techniques more sophisticated, and to use more sophisticated breeding techniques to make more sophisticated and higher yielding and drought resistant plants and the kinds of livestock that we have now resistant to viruses and other kinds of diseases by just classical breeding, which of course takes a long time.
Yeah.
And one can only breed organisms that can reproduce together, that is like with like. And it wasn't until 40 years ago when genetic engineering was invented by Herbert Boyer and Stanley Cohn, University of California, San Francisco, Stanford University, that one could splice DNA, genes from different organisms together, and isolate specific genes from particular organisms from their chromosomes that contain thousands of genes. And that started the genetic engineering revolution. And that genetic engineering revolution allowed one to essentially put genes into organisms, that is, make GMOs the DNA way, that they weren't born with. And that led to plants that have very, very important traits, such as herbicide resistance and insect resistance and viral resistance and drought resistance and all kinds of other things that you couldn't do by regular breeding. And it led to animals, more musculature and other kinds of things, and led to salmon, which could grow faster and grow at a faster rate that couldn't have been done by conventional breeding. And it led to, believe it or not, human GMOs. There are humans that have genes that are walking around today that they weren't born with, because in many cases they were born with lethal diseases, lethal genetic diseases. And it's only by adding genes to their blood cells that we're able to survive. And so genetic manipulation today using DNA has revolutionized science, revolutionized agriculture, revolutionized medicine, revolutionized almost every field you can imagine, forensics, anthropology, evolutionary biology, but the applications that are important for humankind have been just fabulous. And so we have classical breeding, we have adding a gene to an organism, and now we have the CRISPR revolution, which is very exciting, and for which the Nobel Prize was awarded to Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier last year. And now we have the ability to edit, that is change, like a typewriter, the DNA composition of any gene in any organism in a very simple way. And these techniques have gotten so simple and so easy to do that many of them, not even tongue-in-cheek, could be done on your kitchen table, which opens up all kinds of new ethical issues and other kinds of issues in terms of biohacking and all kinds of things, and access issues and social equity issues and all those issues. There are tremendous ethical issues changing our germline and doing germline gene therapy and all kinds of things that we couldn't even have dreamed about in previous years. And the science is moving so quickly, as you know, doing these things, that some of the things we do in our laboratories couldn't even have been done 2 years ago. And so it's a remarkable, remarkable revolution, and being part of it has been very exciting.
It's so exciting to hear you sort of just go through a brief history of genetic engineering and sort of lay it out like that, because the technology is applied in all of these different ways. And as you touched on, and we'll come to later, there are misconceptions about GMO foods. But when you think about breeding and this being a more efficient way of getting results to meet human needs, it sort of reframes it, and it's more of a marketing question, I guess, in that case. And when you were also talking about gene therapy and how this is revolutionizing medicine, and then also CRISPR, my ears picked, because we're doing CRISPR work in our lab. And when I started, I was blown away by how relatively easy and accurate it actually is. So a lot of these developments,
it's amazing.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. And it does move really quickly, the technology. And then I think the idea that scientists aren't that creative is completely undone when you see how quickly scientists respond to these technologies and apply it in their own work.
How do we use this science to create for future generations a more humane and equitable civilization? And I think that's really very profound for those of us that do these things at the bench.
Yeah, Bob, I agree with you. So you touched on CRISPR. So I am working in the field of human genomics, and I completely agree. It's really advanced significantly over the last decade, thanks to state-of-the-art technologies like CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing. Your current research uses genomic technologies also to identify all the genes required to make a seed. So I imagine some of these techniques are being applied to your work too. Could you break that down a little bit? Is it different or is it the same?
I think it's exactly the same. I think one of the things about genetic engineering is it's universal. And so when you work with DNA at the bench, it doesn't matter whether it's a pumpkin plant or a tobacco plant or a human cell or a heart cell or a liver cell. One of the amazing things is that these organisms, these higher organisms, all are governed by the same rules. And one can translate the techniques that can intervene and dissect those rules from kingdom to kingdom. And that's what's so exciting. And so we're trying to understand all the genes that are responsible for making a seed, because seeds are, one, the basis of all agriculture, because you have to plant things in the ground for the most part. And two, seeds are really, in some places, 75% of the calories that we consume. And so they're extremely important for food, both for animal and human consumption. soybeans have 30-35% protein, 20-25% oil. When one eats edamame, they're eating proteins, but they're really the results of a few genes. Question is, why are those genes only active in the seed? And how can you improve the seed, let's say, of a soybean plant to have more proteins so that you have a higher yield? And so all of these techniques, whether they're CRISPR, whether they're classical breeding, whether they're just inserting a new gene into the cell, all those things help unravel the mysteries of how genes are regulated as organisms change from a single cell into multicellular. We do it with plants, but you do it with humans and other people do with animals. And what are those rules? How do genes get switched on and switched off in their trajectory of going from a single cell to a multi-cell organism? And with plants, particularly ones that are important for agriculture, it's critical because they're the basis of our food supply. And we're in a really difficult, difficult situation because one, populations are going up too much across the globe, 7 to 9 billion people in the next, 10, 20, 30 years. And then land that's used for agriculture is shrinking as the population goes up. There's deforestation, there's urbanization, there's less land for agriculture. That means the food supply has to be increased on a smaller amount of land. And then more significantly, we have climate change. 121 degrees up in British Columbia next to Vancouver.
Wow.
This is what happened yesterday. I mean, this is unheard of.
120, really?
Yes, 120 degrees yesterday. And so that's like Death Valley in California. And so how do you face a population that's increasing, a world with a population that's increasing, and climate change? And frankly, if you can't have the type of climates that we have now, for example, in the United States in the Midwest, you might not be able to grow corn and soybean and other kinds of crops. So you might not be able to grow crops in the Central Valley of California. And so as it becomes more difficult to grow food, then that leads to social unrest. There's no question about that, because if there are shortages of food supply, that's going to lead to sociological and political difficulties. And it'll lead to, countries getting even more xenophobic than they are now. And so we have to solve these problems. And some of the solutions are really the fabulous science that we have that can get to the heart of the issue. For example, if we could learn to understand how seeds are formed, then one could perhaps make plants that make more seeds. So each pod of a soybean has 3 seeds. If you can make a pod which has 6, you've now doubled the capacity of that plant to make seeds and make food. So if you could get more seeds on plants, and if you could grow plants on a smaller amount of space that would be higher yielding, you can now improve the food supply, smaller, let's say, patch of land and smaller footprint. And so you're getting to a more sustainable kind of agriculture. And then, of course, along the way, cut down on a lot of the environmental assaults that are sort of associated with agriculture as it's done today. So it's critical that we understand all of these basic rules at the DNA level, because somewhere on the face of this earth, there's a plant that grows in a desert. There's a plant that grows high in the, altitude in the mountains. There's plants that grow under cold conditions. And all that is because of genes and how they're regulated under those conditions. And if we can understand those processes, we can do almost anything we want to do by using genetic manipulation, more sophisticated, but making new crops just like our ancestors did thousands of years ago. So I think the future's difficult, challenges, but it's very exciting. With a lot of young, really brilliant kids going into science, we can really make some inroads.
And when you frame it that way, it makes science sound super cool and very, very exciting and interesting, because by having that understanding of the genetics of these seeds and then sort of figuring out how to adapt the growth of these plants, like you were saying, so that you use up less space, so you're not having to use as much land.
Or water or inputs or things like, yeah, all of it.
Or water, or be keeping up with climate change, adapting to climate change. It's just so powerful. And I don't think I don't think that occurs to people a lot when they think about genetic engineering. And I mean, when you were talking about this, it also kind of, I had a parallel thought, which was early on in genetic engineering, when you think of livestock and growing, you know, cattle that have more meat that are more muscular, growing soybeans that have more proteins, it's sort of a similar thing, but at least without the ethical concerns of, you know, cattle farming, for example. Historically speaking, we've touched on this a little bit, but consumers, I think they are a little bit wary of GMOs. And a lot of that resistance, as you've mentioned, is based on misinformation. And I think just from this conversation alone, maybe that will shift some people's perceptions. But what do you think GMOs, I mean, you've talked a lot about the potential and the promise of GMOs today, but what are some of the valid concerns? Do you think that there is anything that is actually still valid in a bit of that, you know, resistance?
You know, from my perspective, the technology is so sound and it's so safe. If we're just talking about, for example, crops, not GMO bacteria or GMO humans or things like that, these are the most tested crops in the history of humankind. I'll give you an example. And all of this is changing, of course, because of CRISPR. But let's just take the situation of a genetically engineered soybean for herbicide resistance, so to speak. In order to get that crop released for making seeds that can be grown by farmers and sold to the public, so to speak, used in food supply, it took about 10 years and took about approval. It took about $200 million and it took testing, toxicity testing, amino acid composition testing, took approval from the USDA, the EPA, and the FDA. So there's a tremendous regulatory framework in order to get these things out to the market, the most tested plants that have ever been in history and have been acknowledged to be safe for human consumption. And now there's been hundreds and hundreds of millions of humans and animals that have eaten the seeds of genetically engineered soybeans, genetically engineered corn, and there's never been one documented case of even a sneeze. Let's contrast that with traditional crops that you can buy food in the grocery store. For example, let's take the peanut. The peanut has not been genetically engineered using DNA, but of course has been genetically engineered by breeding. And as you know, peanut allergens are really, really serious. And hundreds of people die every year because they're allergic to peanuts. And you can't even have peanut butter and jelly sandwiches in the public schools because of peanut allergies. Well, the fact of the matter is that there's no regulation or no oversight of those food crops. And so one could breed, theoretically, a peanut with 10 times the amount of peanut allergen in its seed than there is now, and there's no oversight for that. On the other hand, one could use genetic engineering, and it has been demonstrated in the lab, that one could make a hypoallergenic peanut, that is the protein that causes the allergenicity, can be eliminated by genetic engineering, but yet it's going to take 10 years or more in order to be able to get that through regulatory processes. So that's the irony here, that people are already eating foods that do have dangers and are harmful to them, and they don't object to that. But because there's this sort of perception which has been made, a very concerted perception over the years by people that are just not in favor of this technology, that inserting a gene into an organism is something bad, it's been very difficult to overcome. And quite frankly, this is one thing that's actually kind of depressed me very much in my research career, because it set the field back, this so-called GMO controversy. But I'm kind of happy to say that the tide is turning, and turning very rapidly, where people are realizing that a lot of these misconceptions and a lot of these concerns are really not something to be totally concerned with, because there hasn't been any real problems using these GMOs. It's really no different, actually, than when genetic engineering was invented with DNA in the 70s. There was a tremendous pushback against using that technology. And it wasn't until individuals demonstrated that you could insert a human gene in a bacteria and get it to make insulin and use that insulin as a drug to treat diabetes that people said, oh my God, look at the good that this technology can be done. And we're going to use it. And that controversy just died out instantaneously. So I think the same thing will happen, and particularly with CRISPR, because using CRISPR in agriculture now, that is the ability to tweak a gene in a crop, has non-regulated status in the United States and many other countries, because they deem it no different than a mutation in one of the nucleotides. And so that's changing the game dramatically, because One could, for example, have a small tomato, which is growing in the Andes, but is very bitter to the taste, so you wouldn't use it as a food, but yet it might be resistant to a particular fungus because of a gene that it has. And so then if you look at the domesticated tomato, you know what that gene is, and using CRISPR technologies, you can tweak that gene in the domesticated tomato to be like the one that's resistant to the fungus and the one that grows in the Andes by making a one or two nucleotide change, a very simple change in the genetic code of the gene. And that has non-regulatory status, which means that all of these genetic variation within a species of plants, like wild soybeans or wild tomatoes, all that information in their genomes, which has helped those wild species fight off viruses and bacteria and fungi and all kinds of other useful traits, can now be very quickly translated, because we know the genome sequences of all these varieties of plants, quickly translated by CRISPR into something that can be very useful for agriculture just by tweaking one or two nucleotides in the gene and not having to add a whole, quote, foreign gene, which is what really the controversy of GMOs was primarily about. And so this has changed the landscape dramatically in terms of what we can do using molecular biology and genetic engineering with agriculture.
That's really encouraging to hear. And it does sound like the proof is almost in the product and its need. You know, if diabetes is such a devastating condition to have, so if you have something that, you know, creates insulin and then it cures that or it treats that, then I think it just becomes irrelevant almost once you see how effective these things can be. And hopefully through education, I imagine public perception will begin to sway. But it does seem like there are entrepreneurs and investors who do see the potential in GMOs. And I guess it is a challenge to sway public perception. But it sounds like it's something that isn't unattainable. And those 10 years that were lost will hopefully be accelerated in the next 10.
Yeah, but we're not going to fight the problems that are facing us in agriculture over the next 50 years without using the most sophisticated science as possible. And that's what we've done over the last 100 years. And so the corn plant that one grows today is very different than the corn plant that people grew in 1920. So for example, in 1920, a farmer could create about 30 bushels of corn per acre, which could feed maybe 20, well, it took a very, 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 very a large amount of agricultural workers to make only 30 bushels per acre of corn. But today, you can do that and make corn that can be planted and get 200 bushels per acre. That is over a tenfold increase in the amount of bushels of corn per acre. And you can do that with only two or three workers. And so the science has really just completely transformed how much food we can make over the last 100 years. And now adding on top of that genetic engineering, such as CRISPR and other kinds of things, the prospects for even doing even better than that, maybe even making a corn plant that you can get 1,000 bushels per acre, which increases the food supply, again, on a smaller amount of space of land, will be fabulous in helping to alleviate hunger and other kinds of things.
Yeah, I mean, paradoxically, we're experiencing both a food waste and a food scarcity problem in the US and other places as well. So it sounds like this could really tackle the food scarcity problem. But in terms of food waste, do you think that this technology could simultaneously tackle both? One thing that comes to mind is how, you know, quickly things expire and pass their sell-by date before they're used. Yeah, do you see it working for both, or is it more the food scarcity problem?
No, I think, you know, it's interesting that the first GMO was a flavor saver tomato.
Oh.
And that is that tomatoes that didn't ripen as quickly as, let's say, non-genetically engineered tomatoes. Now, that's really an important trait, because imagine that your culture is dependent upon bananas for a primary source of proteins. And imagine harvesting the bananas and getting them to the market, and you have bad roads and bad infrastructure, a lot of those bananas may ripen too quickly and therefore rot before they get into human hands. But if one could engineer the banana like the original flavor saver tomato, that will buy more time for the ripening process to go more slowly, and therefore you have more time to get the bananas to market before they rot, and they can get into human mouths and stomachs a lot faster. And so that's a really prime example of how controlling the rate at which fruits ripen, whether they're avocados or bananas or tomatoes or any of these fruits that will rot and have to be thrown out, there's technology that we can use to be able to slow that down because we understand the biology of the system.
Yeah.
And I think that's the key. We're not doing anything empirically. When one engineers, for example, a plant or an animal, but let's say a plant, one knows what the gene is, where the gene is active, when it's active, the extent to which it's active, and one can engineer all of those things and put them back into a plant so that there's really no mysteries to know exactly what that gene is doing. And that's a big advantage over of molecular engineering over classical breeding, because classical breeding was empirical, and sometimes you don't know what you're going to get.
This is everything that we've spoken about so far just is, I don't know, it's very inspiring, and it feels like the science is really going to help us to tackle a lot of problems moving forward. And I know that you are the director of the Seed Institute, so I imagine that some of the mission and the goals are associated with some of the things that we've been talking about. But just before we end the interview, what is the Institute all about and what is the goal?
It's a consortium of academics that work on seeds and different universities, University of California, Berkeley, University of California, Davis, UCLA, and a bunch of us got together and collaborate on our science. We get joint grants and have joint students and have joint meetings and joint publications. And the goal is to try and understand in a very simple way, what are the rules that govern how seeds are formed? And it's been a very, very fruitful and very exciting collaboration that's produced a lot of major insights into how seeds form. And it's produced a lot of students that have then populated the area of seed biology in different universities and institutes around the globe. Has been kind of an exciting endeavor and just a lot of fun to get together with a bunch of colleagues thinking about scientific problems in similar ways.
Wow, what an amazing moment to be involved in this work. And it's incredible that the work that you've spent so much of your life working on is really going to turn the tide, I think, in how we tackle a lot of the problems that we're faced with, from climate change, food scarcity, social issues. And hopefully may inspire, you know, companies and startups to also be interested in plant-based products that take advantage of this technology as well.
I think it's a really exciting time. After being at UCLA since the year 1973, way before you were born, I have no desire to hang up my boots.
Thank you so much, Professor Goldberg. Honestly, the pleasure is all ours. We're so excited to be able to talk to people like yourselves who are doing such incredible work and share it with as many people as possible. Thank you again for your time. Keep up the amazing work. I can't wait to see what happens next with everything that you're doing with the Seed Institute.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We'll be back after this quick word from our sponsors.
Bioscience LA is the independent innovation catalyst for life sciences and health innovation in the greater LA area, accelerating the growth of funding, space, and talent, as well as messaging and awareness building. With support from LA County, Amgen, PHRMA, Richard Lundquist, Richard Merkin, City of Hope, Cedars-Sinai, among others, we are working with a broad array of stakeholders to grow our ecosystem. Bioscience LA is a proud sponsor of BCLA. Follow us at biosciencela.org and at biosciencela to stay informed. Get involved and be #LongLA. Xencor is an LA area biotech committed to improving patient lives by engineering and developing better biologic medicines. Using their pioneering XMAB technologies, Xencor has created or contributed to over 20 therapeutic antibodies and cytokines in ongoing clinical trials. They are advancing these drug candidates for patients internally and with leading industry partners. And two XMAB antibodies are now FDA approved. Xencor is always looking for scientific talent and has more than 10 research scientist positions available. They offer the opportunity to work on cutting-edge biology and an environment to grow and enhance your career. Learn more and apply at xencor.com/careers.
Thank you so much for tuning into the episode. What an amazing interview. I hope that you learned as much as I did in that interview. My mind was blown by how much knowledge it can be held in one person's brain. To find out more about BCLA or Professor Goldberg, then check out the show notes. And if you like the show, then please take a moment to subscribe and share, because it really does help our visibility and it does take less than a minute. Next month, we'll be starting a new series, our third season, on the A in STEAM, Arts and Designs in Biotech. I am so excited personally for this season, and our team at BCLA are really excited about it too. So make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss it. And this podcast is a BCLA production. This podcast is a BCLA production. Thank you so much to our podcasting team, Kathy Grosh and Ananta Wadwa, my co-producers, Damon Palermo for sound design, Daniel Graves for the fantastic theme music, and of course, the sponsors of this episode, Canon Design, Brainome, Xencor, and Bioscience LA. Until next time, have a fantastic month.